Good morning, good afternoon. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Please go ahead. Your lines are open.
Thank you. Harold Alverstrand? No reply. Doc? I think Doc sent a message that he can't join us. Neha Gupta?
Present.
Hello, Neha. Samad Hussain?
Yeah, I'm here.
Here, thank you.
Manal Ismail?
Yes.
Thank you. Ashgat Joshi?
Yes.
Thank you. Kerry Karp?
Present.
Thank you, Kerry. Mahesh Kulkarni? No response. Xiaodong Li?
I'm here.
Thank you. Good. Xiaodong, welcome. Evangelos Melagrakis? No response. Alexei Mikolayev?
I'm here.
Welcome, Alexei. Panagiotis Papaspilopoulos?
I'm here, Denis.
Good, welcome. Vagelis Vidakis?
Hello, Denis.
Hi, Vagelis. James Seng? No response. Vladimir Shudanov?
I'm on the call.
Thank you, Vladimir. Alexei Sozanov? No response. Joseph Yi?
No, Denis.
Thank you, Joseph. On the team, is Joe on the call? Joe Abley? No. Francisco?
Yes, I'm here.
Kim Davies?
Morning.
Bahir Eshmat?
Yes, I'm here.
Julie Headland?
Here, thanks.
Dennis Jennings, that's me. I'm here. Patrick Jones?
I'm here.
Karen Lentz?
Yes, I'm here.
Nicholas Ostler?
Yes, here.
Kurt Pritz?
Yep, I'm here.
Naila Saras?
Yep, I'm here, thanks.
Steve Sheng? No response. Andrew Sullivan?
I'm here.
Leo Vigoda?
Yeah.
Thank you, everybody. It's a tremendous turnout today. Thank you for being on the call. The first item on the agenda that I circulated earlier, well, only a couple of hours ago, I'm afraid, after the welcome and roll call, is the December face-to-face meeting. Naila, would you like to bring us through that?
Yes, thank you, Dennis. Okay, so the meeting is confirmed for sure 12th, 13th December in Marina Del Rey, California. We're going to have it at the Courtyard Marriott, which is the hotel across the street from the office. 12 of the 17 members on this team have already confirmed they'll be attending in person. We have two more attending remotely. All of the members that have already confirmed that they are coming to California should have received a welcome email from the ICANN Travel Constituency Department by now. Starting the travel details. If you haven't received your email, please let me know. If you have received it, please reply to Joseph. I think emails are coming from Joseph De Jesus. If you received the email, please reply to him as soon as possible. We're a little over 5 weeks away from the meeting, so as you can imagine, there's a lot that has to happen in a short time. And those that have asked for an invitation letter to help with the visa process should have received a letter yesterday from my colleague Haley. If you do require a letter and you haven't requested one from us, please let us know as soon as you can. And I think this is it. If anyone has questions, please email me or Haley or Joseph, and we'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Naila. So people should have received notification from travel. Is that what you said?
Correct, yes.
And they should have received a letter from Haley about those who need an invitation should have received a letter.
Correct.
Okay, so let's just check. Has anybody got any questions on this or any difficulties or doubts or concerns? Manal, may I ask you, you were needed a letter. I noticed you said that. Have you received that?
Yes, I did. Thank you.
Excellent. Who else needs a letter, and have they received it? Dharma, do you need a letter?
Yes, but I got one yesterday. Thank you.
Excellent. So we seem to, Naila, we seem to be making great progress. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to Haley also.
Indeed. Thank you, Haley. So Naila, Haley, and Joseph in travel are the key contacts for people to email. And Naila, maybe you'll send an email with those email addresses on it just to be sure.
Absolutely. Yes, I will.
Thank you very much indeed. The next item on the agenda is actions on variants. Francisco, you circulated a document last week. Would you like to bring us through that?
Sure. I sent the document last Friday, end of my day in Marinel Bay. I didn't receive any comments unless they arrived this morning. I haven't checked my email, sorry. Basically, the document is a bit short, just one page, describing the six possible actions that we have identified on the variants. Or these actually are general actions that you can take to a domain name. This has been discussed in various case studies, so I'm not sure how much we want to go into detail on this. Dennis, do you want me to read the definitions? How should we handle this?
No, I think they have been circulated. Unless anybody asks you on the call to read them, I think we can go straight to comments and we can go through them one at a time and see if anybody has any comments on each of them. So you might bring us through, starting with block.
Sure. This is the what you do with a name to avoid anyone for having the name. This is what you will do with a variant that is not desired, let's say, but maybe, for example, potentially confusing. This is also something that you use to avoid names that are really sensitive to be ever allocated to anyone.
This is Vladimir.
Vladimir, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to... I'm not sure, Francisco, are we talking about top-level labels or IA definitions? Do they refer to the second-level or higher-level labels as well?
Good point. I would think at first that this applies to any name. Do you see any issue?
Well, I'm not sure I'm not entirely sure if we need to talk about second level labels at all. But if we do, there might be a conflict between these definitions and the established terms that are currently present in the registry agreements.
Right.
I'm talking about blocking and reservation.
Right. Not just the registry agreements, but pretty much any other document that has been given about this before, right? Because these are new definitions, and that will be true for any other definition that we use. The term variant has been misused a lot of times, and we cannot do anything about that. I think I don't see how we can solve what has been used in the past. This is perhaps the only way to do it is for any document that is written in the future. If it's using this reference, it should reference the document that we will produce eventually. As referring to that, I don't see any other way forward.
One possible way would be to say clearly that, for example, these definitions only refer to top-level labels.
Francisco, I think that's a reasonable suggestion for the moment, but I also think, Dennis Jennings here, it would be worth checking the guidebook to make sure or at least to identify any confusion that might arise from these new definitions. Francisco, have we lost you?
No, sorry. I was thinking.
Sorry.
So the guidebook doesn't use these definitions because these definitions were drafted after the guidebook. So if there is an issue, I'm not sure what we can do.
I made a mistake. It was, Alexei, I think, referred to the registry agreement.
And I think this is true for any other document that was written in the past.
Okay. All right.
Then this is Manan.
Yes, Manan, please.
I agree. I think it is just safe to say that the scope of those definitions, at least for the time being is the CLD domains. And I mean, this is the scope of the work of the working group from the beginning, and we're not speaking about lower levels, right?
Correct, and I think that's an agreed clarification which we should make explicit.
And I think whatever is in the registry agreement has to do with lower levels, or does it also include the TLD level?
I presume.
No, I think it's only about the second level and below.
So if we just make this clear that the scope of those definitions is the TLD level, then we're safe, right?
I guess.
So, Francisco, go on to that block, reserve, just to see if there are any quick comments on any of these terms, if you bring us through them all.
Sure. Just quickly, I'm hearing some background noise. If you're not talking on the phone, I would suggest that you mute your phone, please. The next definition, thank you, now it's better. The next definition is reserve, and that's referring to names. I'm sorry, I think I better read the definition. The definition says to set aside a name for potential allocation to a particular entity, between parentheses, a TLD registry in the case of the root. The name is not yet allocated, but could be if when certain conditions are met and only to the particular entity. So this is an action that will apply, for example, to a variant that that is not problematic, let's say, but at the moment is not desired by the registry, but it can be activated in the future. So you are reserving this name to be used by, in the case of the root, for a particular registry, and that registry can activate that variant in the future. This is the idea with reservation or the action to reserve.
Okay.
Are there any comments on that?
This is Ahmad. I'd like to comment.
Please.
Okay, so there's one potential issue in its implementation. I have no issue with the definition, and I'm just thinking whether definition should probably have something in that context. So there is potential to have many variants of a particular string, and in practice what is going to happen is that a very small set of these variants will be delegated or allocated, and perhaps one or two may be blocked. So the largest chunk is actually going to go into reserve. And one of the things which is possible is that in case of reserve, we are not maintaining an active list because that list will become too long. And we may actually maintain an algorithm which will generate those reserve names at runtime. So I'm not sure whether something like that could reflect the definition.
Well, Samad, can I suggest that we turn that around into an issue? That there, under the issue, may be that there may be a very large number of names to be reserved, and how this is resolved is an issue. How this is addressed, how this is solved is an issue.
Sure. Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah? So that we're focusing on issues. And so let's just note that. Okay, next, Francisco.
Thank you, Dennis. The next definition is allocate. This is the first step on the way to activation. The registry makes an administrative association between a string and some entity that requests a string, making the string a potential label inside the zone and a candidate for activation. Allocation alone does not affect the DNS at all. So this is like registering a name in a registry without giving the DNS servers, name servers for that name. So you will have the domain name registered to you, but the domain is not working on the DNS. Is there any comment on this?
This is Sheldon Lee. Yeah, I have a comment.
Go ahead.
I saw that for the terminology allocate, it's a candidate for activation or it's a candidate for delegation.
I'm sorry, I couldn't understand the question.
You mean that allocate. For the second sentence, making the string a potential label inside the zone and attended for activation. So I'm wondering if it's a candidate for activation or is a candidate for delegation.
All right. Okay, I got it. So I think it's activation because activation is the most broader term. We'll see it next, but basically activation encloses delegation. Delegation is one form of doing activation, basically.
Okay, proceed, and we'll see if that addresses it when you've gone through delegation and activation, Francisco.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's okay. We can discuss the when we discuss the terminology for activate. I think.
Yes. Thank you,
Jordan.
Okay, the next definition is delegate. This is the act of entering the parent-side NS, or name server record, in a DNS zone, thereby creating a subordinate namespace with its own SOA, Star of Authority, record. This is better explained on RFC 1034. So that's basically that's the definition of delegate that we have. Are there any comments on this one?
Yeah, this is Armad. Maybe the last sentence could be a footnote.
A reference? Okay.
If it's not part of the definition.
Okay.
Can I take this opportunity to remind people to speak slowly and to speak loudly? There are a lot of people on the call, and it's sometimes quite difficult to hear.
Okay.
Thank you. Francisco.
Thank you. So the next one is mirror. I'm sorry, I think I'm going to change the order here. I think it's better to start with activate, to go next with activate. So activate is the act of entering a parent site DNS record in a zone, for example, NS, DNAME, CNAME, making the name enter resolvable in the DNS. And we should know that delegating a name implies activating it, but activation does not necessarily imply delegation. So this, the differentiation between delegation and activation is delegation only talks about entering NS records, while activation means entering any DNS record related to the name being activated. Are there any comments on this?
Okay, next. Dennis here.
Yeah, this is Sharon Lee. Yeah.
Oh, Sharon, good.
Francisco, I think it is the terminology for delegate. You mean the delegate terminology is derived from the RFC 1034? You mean the delegation only mean the NS record?
This is Andrew. Yes, delegation is the act of putting the NS record on the parent side.
Yep.
So it's just RFC 1035.
Yeah, if you dename a record to another one, it doesn't mean delegation, right?
That's right. That's not delegation.
Okay. So I think I have no objection on that, but I want to clarify for activate. I think it's for activation for the Chinese dominion, based on the definition for in RFC 3743, is activate or activation means from reserve to delegation. That means activation. There is also another terminology for deactivation. That means it's from delegation to reserve. So I think I need to check in our issue report if we will mention this terminology. So I have no objection on current definition, but I think I need to check if we need another terminology for activation.
Thank you, Joe Dong.
There is an issue in 3743 that is inconsistent with this. You're right in that it doesn't distinguish between activation in the sense of delegation. That is, generally speaking, it doesn't talk about the different ways in which you can turn something on in the DNS. But I think this activation in this definition is consistent with what's in 3743.
Okay.
And I think, Xiaodong, you said you were going to check that out and think about it.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Again, a reminder, if people will introduce themselves when they speak, just for the recording, because for note-taking purposes. So finally, Francisco, Mirror.
Yes, so Mirror, this is the newest definition. Basically, it means to activate two or more domain names such that for a namespace starting with one, the namespace starting with the other is isomorphic to the first, subject to the usual DNS loss consistency strictures. Currently, there are two different techniques for this. The first is aliasing, CNAME, DNAME, and other such techniques that direct a name or a tree, effectively substituting one label for the other during DNS lookup. The second is by using provisioning constraints such that an underlying provisioning system always affects a change in all of the names whenever that change is affected in one of the names. And that's the definition we have. Are there any comments on this?
This is Vladimir. Can I jump in?
Yes, please, Vladimir. Go ahead.
I think it's a very good and useful definition. I have just one issue. It talks about the concept of namespaces isomorphic to each other. I do intuitively understand what that means, but is this something well-defined? Maybe it's just me.
Francisco, do you want to take that up?
Actually, I would like to ask Andrew on this. I think the isomorphic part comes from him.
Andrew, over to you.
This is Andrew. I don't really want to defend this too hard. The problem that we have with any kind of mirroring or any sort of alternate name or whatever we want to call it is that the basic idea is that the DNS data is the same, and the problem is that in the DNS, saying what is the same is extremely hard because you've got synchronization among authoritative name servers and you've got problems with caches. So the idea here is that you've got two sets of names, and the pairs are the two sides are supposed to be, how shall I put this? They should have the same effective right hand side. They should have the same effective R data for every name with that root. But I mean, I don't really know how to state that in a way that is practical in the DNS, and I think that that's the central problem with any kind of definition of mirroring.
I like the way that you said it right now, that they have the same resource records.
Well, it's not that they have the same resource records, because the resource record includes the includes the name. And it can't be that they have the same R data completely, because sometimes the R data is going to include, for instance, the in DNSSEC, for instance, the R data can't be the same because the NSEC records, of course, have to cover the actual data from that zone. So it's all extremely awkward how to state this in such a way that it is technically correct and it gets us the result that we want. I guess maybe I can have another pass at this and see if I can get it a little bit more precise. But the basic problem is that the DNS isn't really designed to do this, and so we're going to have the problem that defining it sufficiently rigorously that we get the kind of effect that we want is going to be something that can't actually be implemented. And if we define it in such a way that it can be implemented, then there are holes in there are holes in the definition that allow people to do funny things.
So, Andrew, you're going to do a little bit more work and thinking on that. Dennis here.
I can make another pass at it and see if I can get it right. But the idea is that that if you put the two trees on top of one another, they would be similar in the mathematical sense of similarity, or the geometric sense of similarity, I guess. Without requiring them to be the same.
Okay. Any other comments?
Dennis, yes, please. This is Nan.
You go ahead.
The definition refers to two different techniques. On the second, this is hypothetical, I guess, right? I mean, so far we don't have such a technique in place, right?
This is Francisco. We do. Not in the root, but it's being used in second level and below.
But
okay,
Dennis,
so
Manal, I think you're right. It hasn't been implemented in the root. So there is a question as to whether it's available in the root. It is used at second and other levels. At least that's my understanding. Is that your understanding, Manal?
Frankly, I didn't even know that it was implemented on lower levels. But this also was part of my question. Thank you.
Thank you.
So this is Francisco. Perhaps what we should do is mention that, as far as we know, this has not been implemented. We should mention that this has not been implemented in the root, and probably something needs to be done before these techniques can be implemented in the root. I'm talking about the aliasing part, because the parallel provision is obviously already there. And also mentioning that this has been already implemented in second levels. To mention an example, I know that .cat, the GTLD, is using dname to mirror IDN to the they have a sort of variant. They have an IDN name and the equivalent between quotes name in ASCII only version. It's mirror. That's what they are doing.
Okay.
This is Manel. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Manel.
Just one more question on this. And does this update is being done automatically? I mean, something like the main servers update, the primary and the secondary, or the master and slave, or is this something that is done manually somehow?
Oh, this is a dname. So basically what they do, they enter the dname for the IDN version, and that's it. They forget about it. They just need to update the ASCII version of the name.
And this is Vangelis Segredakis. In .gr, we are using the dname as well between the IDN versions that either have a Tonos or have not got a Tonos. And between them and homographs, like in cases where the Greek characters simulate a domain in Latin characters or vice versa. And there are some very well documented by us issues that derive from the use of the name, which really have been discussed extensively in the DNSX group of the IETF, where Andrew Sullivan is chairing. And we have already requested in the past for something better as a solution, although this is not coming from what I know.
Thank you, Vangelis.
I'm sorry, this is Manel again. Because Francisco, you mentioned dname, and I believe dname is the first aliasing technique or method. But I was trying to seek clarification on the second technique. So is the second technique also related to the dname method?
This is Francisco. The second technique is not using the... It's using only parallel provisioning, meaning when you make a change in one name, you make the change in the other name.
And this is done manually or somehow automated?
It can be done either way. I would think that the best way to do it is automated.
Hi, this is Sarmat. I'd like to come in.
Sarmat, go ahead.
So I think taking Manal's query forward, it may actually be, again, useful to have some clear references to documents which explain these terms, especially name, CNAME, DNAME, and parallel, provisioning, so that people who want to know more about this can follow through. The second is that there may be another technique which can be adopted or developed eventually. So the text from currently onwards is apparently not part of the definition. So it is still an explanatory note. So I think it may actually be useful to do two different paragraphs. First, which just focuses on the definition, and then maybe another one to explain the definition further, but we should not perhaps limit it to two situations. So this could be sort of given as examples.
Thank you, Sarma. That's very helpful, Dennis here. Francisco, would you make a note of that? And I think we've spent enough time on the phone call on the actions here in Section 3. So with your permission, I'd like to move on. I'd like to jump over Item 4, the selected terminology, for the moment and spend a few minutes on Section 5, Andrew, the list of valid code points and variant derivation, because I think a lot of agreement on the list. So would you like to pick that up, Item 5, list of valid code points?
Sure. Okay. We had a discussion on the list about some different proposed techniques for how to generate the list of valid code points and the variants that would go with them. And the consensus appeared to be that there were two different techniques for doing this, one of which is a complete top-down list for any script that you're going to permit, and script, I guess, is the Unicode script property. For any script that you're going to permit in the root zone, you produce a complete list of all of the code points that you would accept from that script and all of the variant rules that you would have for that, and you would need to get consensus from everybody who uses that script, and then that would be the set of rules that would be used. The alternative method is to build it up gradually based on applications from individual, from various people, whoever they are, saying, I want this set of code points, and then that set of code points becomes the list that you work for. So the first has the advantage that it is a complete list, and so if somebody comes along with a new code point that you haven't dealt with, you already have a rule for it. Either you accept it or you don't. The disadvantage with that is that you have to get complete consensus on the part of everybody, some of whom you may not even know, before you can move ahead with a given script. And the advantage of the second strategy is that, or one of the main advantages, is that it's a descriptive set of procedures. That is, it's just an emergent property of all of the applications that you have. But a disadvantage, of course, is that a new application can come along and change the rules, and then you have to work out exactly how you're going to cope with that rule change. There's also the potential for some chaos there because you've got different people who have different ideas of how things are going to work. And so some of that may result in contention between different groups. Although, of course, the first strategy also has that contention. It just happens earlier in the process. I think what we agreed on the list is that we're going to write down these two possibilities. I sent some candidate text to the list. I got one reply from Dr. Salman Hussein, who said, yes, he thinks that that's probably the right way to go. Maybe it needs some refinement later, but put that in as the starting point. And I haven't seen any comments from anyone else. So if you want to review that text, that would be helpful. I think that Karen is going to include the text in the first draft, but I haven't checked to make sure.
Thank you, Andrew. Dennis here. Any comments from the participants on the call? Dharma, did Andrew correctly characterize your contributions?
Yes, I have. I think that summary he presented does bring out the issues, and I guess we can also look at this once the actual text comes out in the report as well.
Thank you, Sarmad. Anybody else want to pick up this point? Okay, good. So that's going to be a solid chunk of text on in the first draft of the report. Okay, let's go back to selected terminology. Nicholas, would you bring us through each of these, starting with homograph? But I thought we'd actually abandon homograph as a term.
Dennis, sorry to interrupt, but there are actually two more questions in number 5. Are we going to come back to those? Or?
Oh, I beg your pardon, yes. Please, you mean who develops the sanctions the lists and who and how can update the lists? Are those the two questions?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You want to take the lead on that, Sarmad?
Sure. So I think one of the things which we need to understand is that this is going to be a list which will be, which will have to be maintained, because it is based on Unicode, and Unicode is going to keep changing. So I think that's something which could be listed as an issue. It's, I'm not sure whether it's an issue or not. But in any case, there has to be some mechanism to update this. And if this gets updated, another thing which I had actually raised earlier as well was that if these tables are being accepted, it should not be an arbitrary process. It should go through the same checkpoints as different strings go through, because they are going to be used to automatically generate the variants.
Excuse me, this suddenly the voice is too small.
Thank you, Xiaodong. Sarmad, some people are having difficulty hearing you. Perhaps you could speak a little louder. I can hear you quite well, but perhaps you could say it again, but a bit louder.
Okay, or if that doesn't work, maybe somebody can summarize what I'm saying. Anyway, so again, what I'm trying to say was that first point is that since it's dependent on Unicode, we, I think, need to very clearly articulate that this will have to be maintained explicitly, because Unicode is going to be changing over time as well. The second thing, I think I lost track of
The second thing that you mentioned, Sarmad, was who develops and sanctions the list, who authenticates it, and in particular, if it's updated, what rigorous process did it go through to make sure that it's correct and valid and acceptable to the community?
Right.
I think that's what you're talking about.
Exactly. So what I was suggesting was that it should go through the same authentication verification process as a string acceptance process, because this will in reality will be generating variants which will go into the which will be potentially delegated.
Yes, thank you. So I think those are key issues that we should highlight as issues. We don't have to solve them right now, but in the next solutions exploration phase, we certainly will have to find solutions for them. So we need to flag those two points as key issues. How are these code point repertoires developed and approved, and how are they maintained and updated?
Mm-hmm.
Does that summarize your point, Sarmad?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. So any comments on that from anybody on the call?
This is suddenly a comment,
please.
On this.
Yes, please, go ahead.
I totally agree with your summary, Dennis. I think it's a very, very important issue. But I don't know if we can find a solution on that. But it's a very key issue.
Thank you, Jordan. The JetWork has effectively found the solution for that, for the hand script, has it not?
Yes, it's dependent on if you want to rely on the script or rely on the language. Yeah, if we want to find a list for valid code point for hand script, but I don't know if we can do that.
Okay.
Yeah, only to find a list for valid code point is much easier to find what's the very good point for this list.
Okay. Anybody else want to comment from another language script perspective?
This is Andrew. I just want to comment on that last item. I don't see how the JET guidelines, or indeed the generalization of it, I don't see how either of those has solved this problem. The fundamental question here, So in RC 3743, the way you decide the list of valid code points comes from your language table, which and it's the list of code points that is in column one. The way in which the list of code points in column one gets decided is still a registry implementation problem. And so there isn't actually any external mechanism that we have for deciding that. Every case is going to be the same. Moreover, 3743, and indeed any generalization of this, has always sort of assumed that this could be done by script or it could be done by language, and it isn't clear which way. And the proposals that we have are the outlines that we have right now, the text that I sent to the list, is intended to point out that this is a policy decision that needs to be made by the operator of the zone to raise the issues such that we say, you know, if you try to do this by script, then you're going to have to get agreement on the whole script, and you're going to have to try to figure out what to do about cases where you need things that are outside that script property. And those are just open issues for implementation. The alternative is to do it completely descriptively, in which case the maintenance problems that we have talked about already don't come up, but we have a different set of problems. Like, for instance, what do we do about conflicts between these two things if they become politically charged or something like that? And how do we prevent people from coming up with stupid lists of scripts, where they basically give us a list of scripts that is everything in Unicode and no variant policies or something like that, which is a possibility that somebody could submit. So those are the tensions in each of the directions that we have to go, but I don't see that there are any alternatives apart from those two. If there are other alternatives, it would be nice if somebody wrote the text and sent that to the list.
Thank you, Andrew. Comments?
So this is Hamad. I suggested a third possibility, which is a hybrid of these two, where one could go and do a script-level solution to whatever extent possible, and then leave out things which are not one on those things which where the committee or the team or the community does not reach a consensus, and do those in a bottom-up kind of way.
Thank you, John.
This is Vladimir. I think Andrew raised a very interesting problem, and we took some time to discuss it, but isn't that something that should be solved on a later stage, not on the stage of the issues report? So I think I would prefer an approach that we just state that such problem exists, and then on the next stage of the project take some time to thoroughly discuss it and find out a good solution for that.
Yes, that is correct, but sometimes it is useful to explore the solution space in order to make sure that we really understand the issues. But you're absolutely correct. The solutions are for the next phase. The issues are for this phase. Thank you for reminding us. Okay, Andrew, I think that deals as best we can with this, and there'll be text to be discussed on the list. Yeah?
Yes, please.
Right. Now going back to item 4 on the agenda, Nicholas, selected terminology, starting with homograph, and again my comment, I thought we'd killed off homographs and replaced them with homoglyphs, but have I misunderstood? Nicholas?
No, you haven't misunderstood, Dennis, but before I get into this, how much time have we got? As far as I can see, we've already had our full hour. Oh, no, we're an hour and a half, aren't we? Sorry.
We are an hour and a half, yes.
Yes, that's right. Okay. The report mentions homograph only to say that it's not going to define it on the grounds that it's a term which is likely to lead to confusions between different sort of levels of semantic interpretation. And then it goes on to define homoglyph and also approximate homoglyph. That's why the term approximate is in parentheses in the second item there, I think. Anyway, I don't know whether you want me to go through the whole list. It is all there written down clearly. There have been some discussions, and I wonder whether it might be sensible to cut to those issues that arose, or would you like me to go through the whole thing?
No, no, if you feel it appropriate, cut straight to the issues, Nicholas.
Yes, right. There were comments from Carrie and Sarmad quite soon after I submitted the paper, and I've sent my replies to them just this morning, in fact. As far as I could see, two issues arose. One was the question which was raised by Carrie of whether we're actually talking about here about just GTLDs or whether TLDs more generally should be seen as what we are defining terms for and ultimately giving policy for. I said I didn't know that we had any right to talk about CCTLDs, but Carrie obviously thought that it didn't make much sense to distinguish GTLDs from CCTLDs, and Andrew weighed in very recently to say that, in fact, that there could be no sense in having a different rule for CCTLDs from GTLDs, because what we're basically talking about here is the root. So perhaps I should simply accept that we are talking about TLDs here.
Yes, Dennis here. Nicholas, if you would indeed, there's only one route and partitioning it just doesn't make any sense. Talking
right,
about
good.
CCTLDs and GTLDs.
So I guess I can adjust the text as Carrie suggested without any further ado. There was another item where Carrie thought that one of my statements contradicted another of my statements. This had to do with whether there could actually be homoglyphs within a single script. It's clear there can be homoglyphs within a single script if one is talking about a single language. For the example which is usually given is that of schwa and turned e, which look identical but have different code points. However, when you start talking about two languages which use the same script, it is sort of arguable whether the abstract characters involved there are the same or different. I'm open to correction on this, but any normal linguistic analysis would suggest that the abstract characters underlying the Unihan characters as they're used for Chinese are different from the abstract characters as they are used, say, for Japanese. They're pronounced differently, they combine differently. The only thing they have in common is that they are historically the same items, and by and large, they have the same meanings. So if we look at the definition of abstract character, which is made available by Unicode, it talks about a unit of information and doesn't really give us any more content than that. And so in practice, when we are identifying abstract characters, what we talk about is code points. Now, this is part of the reason which I think talking in terms of homoglyphs is rather confusing. What we are interested in here is the relationship between code points and glyphs. And homoglyphs doesn't actually, as it is here anyway, doesn't really encourage us to focus on that, which is the sort of business area for this whole field. So that's the second issue which came up. Perhaps a little bit strange, but having written these definitions, I would discourage people from using the term homoglyph as much as possible. because I think it's likely to lead to confusions. A second, a related confusion which came up was Salman's suggestion, I'm not sure how serious it was, that the relationship between simplified characters and traditional characters in Chinese could be seen as an example of sinoglyphs, which are which is a term we did not define here, but which would seem to mean something like synonymous glyphs. Now, they are not alloglyphs by the definition that we have here, because they have both different code points and different glyphs, so they're just unrelated pairs as far as our terminology is concerned. Nevertheless, of course, at some level, we do want them to be synonymous. So it might be a way of using the term synoglyph if we want to use it as a different term and not synonymous with alloglyph. But in general, I would discourage that as well, since the kind of relationship that we're talking about there is not something that we otherwise deal with. It's the relationship between words and meanings rather than symbols and their reference.
Nicholas, Dennis here. Two questions, I suppose. One, is this ready for a general discussion, or is there more work among the linguistic experts need to be done? And second question is, or I suppose comment, it'd be very helpful if there were examples of each of these so that we could, we normal mortals who clod around and don't normally talk about glyphs.
If I could answer your first, your second point first. The way I've organized this is to have a discussion of the issues with lots of examples.
Right.
And then move to hard, cold definitions afterwards. So I hope that anybody reading the document will actually understand those points that I've made there.
I'm just
on the question of whether more linguistic work is needed, I personally doubt it, because I think the terms are here defined adequately. And what I've been talking about in terms of issues have been the kind of items which have come out in the discussion, but which may actually not have concrete bearing for our document. What does it interest me, I suppose, in a way, is I have organized the document in the way I mentioned, with a lengthy introduction and then the definitions. That means that it's not immediately evident how it should be integrated with the definitions document as we have it at the moment, which by and large is just definitions and doesn't have the sort of extra explanations which I've been talking about.
Thank you, Nicholas. Does anybody want to comment on this? I'm particularly concerned to see whether this is something you should spend time on this call or put back on the list. Kerry, I presume, and Sarma.
Yeah, okay. There's something that actually was at the heart of my comments, and that is the Unicode terminology. Unicode serves the typographic industry. I mean, it's a matter of how one makes a transition from slugs of lead type to raster images. And whether we talk about glyphs or we talk about graphs or whatever we talk about, there's the thing that you look at, the squiggle that is on your screen, that is what's potentially confusable with another squiggle that you see on your screen. And objectifying it, regarding it as a perceptive thing, that's still the essence of the problem. So there's some notion of squiggular proximity that we have to get into this discussion without using previously laden terms. And one of the concepts that we don't see here is that of font, which is where all of this actually is projected. The relevant correlate to an abstract character or to a set of abstract characters is a glyph palette in a font. And where two code points share the same glyph, the exact same glyph on that palette, there's no question about what we've been calling homoglyphic identity. But we're fishing around for latitude in that, hopping from one set of terms to another set of terms. And I don't really see how we're going to be able to do this without somehow introducing the notion of commonly used fonts as the basic reference. There doesn't have to be any absolute reference font, but in a given working environment, what is the likelihood that the schwa and the turned e are going to use the same glyph, and what's the likelihood that they're not? Because any absolute relationship doesn't exist. As long as they're separate abstract characters, they're separate abstract characters. But the moment we start talking about code points, we're talking about something that's devoid of any visual identity, and it's in the visual plane that that our concern arises.
Yes, but you haven't mentioned glyphs, Carrie. We do have them as our proxy for visual patterns.
But I thought you were trying to get away from the notion of... are you comfortable with the notion of glyphs and it's the homoglyph that you think is potentially going to be using?
It's just the idea of thinking of variants in terms of homoglyphy, which worries me, largely because the other term when one's talking about two items, the implicit term is the abstract character. And the abstract character can only be concretely defined in terms of code point.
But that's what I'm questioning right now. Yes, it can be defined in terms of code point, but it is perceived in terms of the way those code points are projected on a glyph palette.
Yes, and then you're saying that the glyphs are actually indeterminate themselves because they have to be rendered through some font.
Just so, just so. And again, I mean, there are demonstrator fonts that are specifically intended to render such things as the distinction between a schwa and a turned E visible. But the interesting thing there is that nobody would be able to tell you which is which without knowledge of how the font developer dealt with it. So there's a second level to the definition, and that's either they're identical, or if the font does not render them absolutely identically, nobody would be able to know which was which without external contextual information.
Yes. Well, is this an item for the... we haven't really talked about the role of fonts, and I suppose it's arguable that the issues which arise with the clarity or the obscurity which results from using particular fonts should actually more be in the taxonomy of variants than it should be in actual definitions of what counts as a homoglyph.
Unless we want to just have a footnote in those definitions, noting that the Unicode definitions are intended primarily to serve the typographic industry rather than be statements of what the linguistic community might otherwise come up with.
Mm-hmm.
So we're borrowing terminology from a very clearly bounded context, shoehorning it into another context that's very poorly defined, and wondering why we can't converge on absolute consensus about what we're going to put forward.
Yes, although, of course, typography is moving more into a digital format more and more. So, in a sense, it's moving more and more towards the kind of world we're working with, rather than being less so defined.
Yeah. Now, one final observation before I shut up. This business about synoglyphs, as it might be appropriate in the CJK context, how about calling them sinoglyphs?
Yes, I never know whether these things are intended as serious proposals or as clever jokes. That's the trouble. Maybe Chinese leads themselves to that. Yeah. But I was hoping that perhaps some of the representatives who've worked with CJK might have a view on that. It may be, I have done my best to summarize the issues that have arisen in correspondence since I produced the text. But it may be that this has all happened too recently for people to actually take it on board. Perhaps we could ask the Chinese participants to take a particular look at this and comment on the debate as it's gone so far. That might be helpful.
So let me ask then, Dennis here. Sarmad, you made a comment on the list. Do you want to make a comment on this discussion?
Sure. Okay. So a few things. First of all, thank you to Nicholas for incorporating the comment. So I want to. I recently, in a separate discussion, in a separate context, realized that there is also a set of definitions which are proposed by IDNA protocol itself. So this is RFC 5890. And they talk about code.
Right, what was that number again? RFC
5890.
5890.
That's
you.
The IDNA protocol, which is 5890 through 5894. And the first RFC is internationalized domain names for applications, definitions, and document framework. So I think there may be a potential, and I'm going to find out more on this. There may be some difference in our understanding of a character and how this RFC is actually defining a character. So the difference may be from a user perspective versus from a protocol perspective. And so I think if that difference occurs, we need to at some point get those two things on the same page. So that's just a separate comment. So as far as the as this discussion is concerned, so clearly, as you know, Kerry and Nicholas pointed out, there are actually three levels. There is this underlying level, which is the abstract character, and then there's this intermediate level, which is the code point itself, and then there's the surface form, which is the glyph. So at least that's how I look at it, and these three things are actually what we're trying to capture in our various discussions. So I am actually quite comfortable with the glyphs. There should be some discussion with fonts. I agree with Carrie, but I think that is something which could be done in issues rather than in definitions. So I guess agree with Nicholas's comment there.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Sarmad, but I think, forgive me, but we've 10 minutes left. I think this discussion needs to go back onto the list, and certainly people like me need to read a little bit more to understand what's going on here. So would you pardon me if I cut this discussion short, Sarmad? Is that okay with you?
Well, no problem. Please.
Thank you very much, indeed, because I'd like to spend the last 10 minutes on the last item, the taxonomy of variants. And Andrew, maybe you'd lead this off. There's a very substantial document there which is available for people to comment on. But Andrew, over to you.
So I did send some questions about changing the taxonomy. I had an action item after the Dakar meeting to update the taxonomy, and I went to do it, and I discovered that whereas I knew how to do all of the rest of the things, and I summarized those in my mail to the list, there was a suggestion for a split in the taxonomy for certain Arabic code points, and I couldn't tell which ones were which. And I did review the transcript that was sent around of the meeting, and it was similarly ambiguous about which code points needed to go in which places. It has something to do with optional marks versus non-optional marks, but that doesn't help me because I don't use Arabic script. So if somebody can tell me which things should go where, then I can make the update to the taxonomy, and then we can put that to bed, because I think it's almost done. So it would be great if we could just get that out of the way, say, yes, this is complete, and put it into the document. Oh, and there was a follow-up question on the list from Alexi, I believe, about code points that go together versus a single code point. I'm not sure whether we want to include that. Edmund made the argument that we shouldn't. It doesn't seem to me that it does any harm to include it, so I was planning just to include it on our list.
Thank you, Andrew.
Has it been included on the list as in the most recent version that you sent round, or is this something which has not yet happened?
It's all something that hasn't happened. So I didn't actually touch the document at all compared
to. Yeah, I didn't see any difference.
There was nothing compared to what happened prior to the Dakar meeting, and all I did was describe in there, because there were only two changes that came out of the Dakar meeting. But one of them is too hard for me to understand as things stand. I need more detail before I can make the update.
Andrew, this is Manal.
Go ahead, Manal.
One of the suggestions I recall I made was to have the cases and lost information as a separate category, as a number 4, and that would include optional diacritics from an Arabic script point of view. But I was not sure whether this would also apply on the rest of the script.
So
I made the suggestion. I was not sure about the implications, and I don't recall whether we agreed or not.
It's possible that we'll need another round after making that change, because I want to look at it too. But before I can do it, I need to know which things fall into that category of the optional stuff, because the review of the meeting notes and another review of the report didn't make it clear to me which code points were the truly optional cases and which ones were some other combining marks that weren't really optional but would be excluded for other reasons and so on. So it's that distinction that I think is necessary for me to be able to proceed. And maybe I just need to spend 5 minutes in an instant message conversation or something like that with you and Sarmad or something, in order to try to get this sorted out. Would that work, or an email exchange or something?
Yeah, this is Harmad. So, yes, I think I understand what you're referring to, and we can do this over email pretty quickly.
Yes.
Manal, does that address your concerns?
Yes.
Thank you very much indeed.
To have that discussion, this is Nicholas here. I'd appreciate being copied in on it, because I'd quite like to know what the issue is. Since I wasn't at Dakar, I have not been privy to it as yet.
Noted. Good. Thank you, Nicholas. Okay, Andrew, does that deal with taxonomy for the moment?
It does from my point of view, yes.
I have a comment on that.
Yeah, please. Francisco, go ahead.
So on the email from Alexei Mikhailov, I was thinking that this is going further on the visual similarity issue, which for which we already have a process in place in ICANN, in the new utility process and in the IDN's utility fast track. So I was thinking that maybe there is no real benefit on including this in the taxonomy, because this is already being taken care of by other processes in the delegation of TLDs. Actually, the whole issue of visual similarity is kind of something that has been in discussion, whether it is in the scope of the variant or not. So I don't see the benefit on expanding further on this field.
Francisco, thank you. Dennis here. But in principle, this is an identification of issues rather than solutions, but it would be worth a footnote whenever we talk about visual similarity that there is a process for dealing with this already in the GTL, in the TLD space.
Yes, could I jump in here too, Nicholas?
Go ahead.
In my definitions, one of them that I was asked to produce was visually confusable character. And what I've actually put under there is a whole lot of domain names, URLs, talking about definitions and procedures for detecting them. I think we've tended to wave our hands when this has come up in the past, and rely on, particularly on Andrew's expertise as to what the current state of play is. But I realized that it's actually, it is important, and the materials we've currently brought together on this are not sufficient to clarify the real situation as it is. Nobody, for example, has commented on that particular section of the definitions, and perhaps that's because everybody's as confused as I am. I don't know.
Well, it's certainly not an easy area, Nicholas, but thank you for flagging that. So that's something that people should look at and think about more.
It's Panagiotis here.
Panagiotis, go ahead.
I would like to say something about confusability. It's the issue that we are dealing now in our Identity TLD application, and we believe that there will be such problems in the future, so we have to deal with this issue as well. That's why we put it in our report that these teams, Latin, Cyrillic, and Greek, should work together to find some proposals for it. Thank you.
Thank you, Panagiotis. Okay, anything else that other people want to raise on or any other business in the last couple of minutes that we have? Just do a quick tour of the call. Neha, anything you want to raise?
No.
Sarmad?
I'm okay, thank you.
Manel?
In fact, I had something quick on homoglyphic distance, but I can put this over email if we don't have time.
If you would, I think that would be helpful, Manal. We have just a minute to check on. Thank you. Ashgert, Yoshi?
Hi. Even I would like to comment something about visual similarity thing, and I'll take it to the mailing list, and I'll also ask Dr. Raymond Doctor to note that and reply to the mailing list on the same.
Thank you very much. That's very helpful. Kerry, anything else to raise?
Nope.
Jiadong Li, anything else to raise?
No, thank you very much.
Alexei? Mikhailov, anything else to raise?
On list building approaches, but I'll try to comment on this in the list.
Thank you very much. Panagiotis, anything else to raise on this call?
No, thank you, Tim. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Vagelis, anything else you want to raise? I think we may have lost Vagelis. Vladimir, anything else you want to raise?
Dennis?
Nothing.
Yes, is that Vagelis?
Yes, it's Vagelis. Sorry, I was muted and I thought I was speaking to everyone.
No,
sorry.
No problem.
So,
please proceed. Go ahead.
I would like to raise a point. We must really make sure that it is perfectly clear to all the participants on this group what is the extent of this report. And if it is only for the GTLDs, if it is for second-level domains as well, if the registries that will apply for a new GTLD will have to follow the report, if it is a CCTLD report as well that somebody told earlier, we have to make it perfectly clear to everybody, because if it is a CCTLD, then we have to ask the CCNSO to participate while we are drafting the report. If it is a GTLD only report, there could be different procedures for the application of a GTLD than of the application for a second level domain or a third level domain that the registrar, that the registry has to accept, because we shouldn't expect so many GTLDs in the next few years. Let's say 1,000. Let's say less, let's say more, I don't know how many, but it is going to be completely different to check these applications, which are coming one after the other, but on a steady pace and with plenty of time to review. And this could be a very significant factor in deciding what the procedure for the application should be.
Thank you very much for that. I think the only overlap that was flagged is that the route is a common zone. So in terms of the code point repertoire, there is an overlap between the GTLDs and the CCTLDs, but the point, your point is well made, and we need to take that up on the list and clarify it. I heard from Vladimir, I think, with no comment. And Joseph, Joseph Yi, anything you want to raise in the final seconds? Okay. Thank you, everybody, very much indeed for all your contributions. And in particular, thank you to those of you who promised to continue this discussion and to provide comments on the list. I'm going to close this call. Thank you very much. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Everybody.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for participating in today's conference call. You may now disconnect.